Okay, good afternoon. This is KDVS 90.3. This is a public affairs show called Books and Ideas. I am DJ Safikar. We're broadcasting not far from where the village of Putatoy once stood, inhabited by Patwin Native Americans. This is the second week that we're looking at The Burnout Society by Byung-Chul Han, which was first published in 2010. So before we get to chapters we're going to cover today, I'm going to give a summary of last week's show. Last week there wasn't a show because of the basketball game, so here it goes. The book presents a cultural criticism of our times and the present world. Han argues that the contemporary world is obsessed with achievement and material wealth, and that this results in mass burnout and depression and much unhappiness. The background to this is neoliberalism. Neoliberalism emerged as the Soviet Union was falling. It is a right-wing economic and ideological philosophy and an apologetic celebration of capitalism and making money. It promotes reducing the size of government through privatization and major cuts in social services. Last time, we looked at the first three chapters of The Burnout Society. In the first chapter called Neuronal Power, Han argues that when we look at the landscape of pathology at the beginning of the 21st century, what we find is psychological problems such as depression, loneliness, and mainly burnout syndrome. Han explains our current predicament and the norms that govern our societies in 21st century by contrasting them with the values of the previous century, which he coins the immunological age. Han explains the immunological epoch sought to distinguish clearly between inside and outside, friend and foe, self and the other. Attack and defense determine immunological action. The object of immune defense is the foreign as such. Even if it has no hostile intentions, even if it poses no danger, it is eliminated on the basis of its otherness. But Han contends that the maladies of today do not follow from the negativity of what is immunologically foreign, but from an excess of positivity. Therefore, they elude all technologies and techniques that seek to combat what is alien. According to Han, our age is marked by the disappearance of otherness and foreignness. Otherness is being replaced with difference. Difference does not make anyone sick. His language. In terms of immunology, it represents the same. So before otherness disappeared and prejudice reigned, as it were, a long time ago, a person who's heterosexual, for instance, may have perceived a homosexual person not merely as different, but as less human, someone who's ill or immoral and is up to God knows what, whom may be a danger to me and others in the neighborhood, and I should watch out for. With the disappearance of the other, there was a radical change in perspective. We're less unkind to those who are not like us. We embrace otherness as sameness with the recognition that our identities may have been very different if we were born and raised under different circumstances and in different families and subcultures. My gender, my sexuality, my class and ethnicity, my sensibilities may have been different. I am everyone, and I was once more or less a clean slate. In the second chapter called Beyond Disciplinary Society, Han contrasts the achievement society with the disciplinary society. Han argues that today's society is no longer Foucault's disciplinary world of hospitals, madhouses, prisons, barracks, and factories. It has long been replaced by another regime, namely a society of fitness studios, office towers, banks, airports, shopping malls, and genetic laboratories. 21st century society is no longer a disciplinary society, but rather an achievement society. Also, its inhabitants are no longer obedient subjects, but achievement subjects. They are entrepreneurs of themselves. Han writes, disciplinary society is a society of negativity. It is defined by the negativity of prohibition. The negative modal verb that governs it is may not. Achievement society more and more is the process of discarding negativity. Increasingly, deregulation is abolishing it. Unlimited can is the positive modal verb of achievement society. Its plural form, the affirmation, yes, we can, epitomizes achievement society's positive orientation. Prohibitions, commandments, and the law are replaced by projects, initiatives, and motivation. Capitalism is about productivity, and disciplinary society has its limits. To heighten productivity, the negativity of prohibitions is replaced with the positive scheme of can. The achievement subjects are much more productive. In this way, the achievement subject exploits itself, and it does so voluntarily, without external constraint. It is predator and prey at once. Hahn thinks self-exploitation is simply the latest stage of capitalism. Rather than being pressured to maximize our individual productivity by external forces, we now willingly exploit ourselves in the name of individual achievement and bettering ourselves. Self-exploitation is one of the main characteristics of achievement society. The other is hyper-attention. Chapter 3, which is called Profound Boredom, explores this theme, and it focuses on boredom and contemplation as the way out of our contemporary predicament. Excessive positivity expresses itself as an excess of stimuli, information, and impulses. It radically changes the structure and economy of attention. Perception becomes fragmented and scattered. The attitude toward time and environment, known as multitasking, does not represent civilizational progress. Human beings in the late modern society of work and information are not the only ones capable of multitasking. Rather, such an aptitude amounts to regression, Hahn tells us. We owe the cultural achievement of humanity, which includes philosophy, to deep contemplative attention. Culture presumes an environment in which deep attention is possible. Increasingly, such immersive reflection is being displaced by an entirely different form of attention, hyper-attention. Really, what makes our time different than previous times is internet and the phone. And he calls their influence on us hyper-attention. A rash change of focus between different tasks, sources of information, and processes characterize this scattered mode of awareness. Since it also has a low tolerance of boredom, it does not admit the profound idleness that benefits the creative process. Walter Benjamin calls this deep boredom a dream bird that hatches the egg of experience. If sleep represents the high point of bodily relaxation, deep boredom is the peak of mental relaxation. A purely hectic rush produces nothing new. It reproduces and accelerates what is already available. Benjamin laments that the dream bird's nest of tranquility and time are vanishing in the modern world. Whatever is floating, inconspicuous, or fleeting reveals itself only to the deep, contemplative attention. Likewise, it is only contemplative lingering that has access to phenomena that are long and slow. Thinking has now degraded into mere calculation and the weighing of consequences. All right. This brings us to the chapters we're going to look at today. Chapter 4. I see. Okay. In this chapter, like most of the chapters of this work, Hahn is having a kind of dialogue with some influential thinkers and writers. Thank you. Hahn often begins with agreement on some ideas before issuing a criticism of others. Here Hahn turns to Human Condition by Hannah Arendt, published in 1958. In this work, Hannah Arendt seeks to rehabilitate the vita activa, that is, the life of action, against the primacy a long tradition has granted the vita contemplative, the life of the mind, and to articulate its inner richness in a new way. In her estimation, the traditional view has wrongly reduced the life of the life of action to mere restlessness. Arendt connects her evaluation of vita activa to the priority of action. Arendt analyzes the vita activa via three categories, which correspond to the three fundamental human activities: labor, work, and action. Although Arendt considers the three activities of labor, work, and action equally necessary to complete human life, in the sense that each contributes in its distinctive way to realization of our human capacities, it is action that makes us uniquely human. Accordingly, according to Hahn, this makes her commit to heroic actionism. Hahn notes that for Arendt, modern society, as a society of laboring, nullifies any possibility for action when it degrades the human being into animal laborance, a beast of burden. Action, she maintains, occasions new possibilities, yet modern humanity passively stands at the mercy of anonymous process of living. As Arendt sees it, modernity begins with an unprecedented heroic activation of human capacity, yet it ends in mortal passivity. All forms of vita activa, both the matter of producing and that of acting, sink to the level of simple laboring. I need some quiet, please. In this way, thinking degrades into calculation, mere cerebral functioning, reckoning with consequences. Hahn disagrees with Arendt's explanation for the ubiquity of animal laborance. Hahn maintains that this does not hold up to recent social developments. Arendt maintains that the life of the modern individual is submerged in the overall life process of the species. Under these circumstances, the only active decision would be to let go, so to speak, to abandon individuality and to acquiesce to a functional type of behavior. She appears to be thinking of the absolutization of laboring as an evolutionary step for a species, a step backward. This is how Hahn states it. Arendt assumes that all human activities, if viewed from a sufficiently remote point in the universe, would no longer appear as deeds, but as biological processes. Accordingly, for an observer in outer space, motorization would resemble a biological mutation. The human body surrounds itself with a metal housing in the manner of a snail, like bacteria reacting to antibiotics by mutating into resistant strains. Hahn complains that Arendt's description of the modern animal laborance do not correspond to what we can observe in today's achievement society. The late modern animal laborance does not give up its individuality or ego in order to merge, though through the work that it performs with the anonymous life processes of the species. Rather, contemporary labor society as a society of achievement and business fosters individuality. Hahn claims that if one could abandon one's individuality and dissolve into the life process of the species entirely, one would at least have the serenity of an animal. But the late modern animal laborance is anything but serene. It is hyperactive and hyperneurotic. Hahn claims that there must be another answer to why all human activities in the late modernity are sinking to the level of mere laboring. Hahn argues that the modern loss of faith does not concern just God or the hereafter, but it involves reality itself and makes human life radically fleeting. Life has never been as fleeting as it is today. The general denarrativization of the world is reinforcing the feeling of fleetingness. It makes life bare. Nothing promises duration or substance. given this lack of being, nervousness and unease arise. The society of laboring and achievement is not a free society. It generates new constraints. Excuse me. Ultimately, the dialectic of master and slave does not yield a society where everyone is free and capable of leisure too. Rather, it leads to a society of work in which the master himself has become a laboring slave. In this society of compulsion, everyone carries a work camp inside. This labor camp is defined by the fact that one is simultaneously prisoner and guard, victim and the perpetrator. One exploits oneself. It means that exploitation is possible even without domination. Chapter 5 is called Pedagogy of Seeing. But what Han is discussing here is actually thinking. The life of the mind presupposes instruction in a particular way of seeing. In The Twilight of the Idols, Nietzsche claims that learning to see means getting your eyes used to calm, to patience, to letting things come to you. That is, making yourself capable of deep and contemplative attention, casting a long and slow gaze. Such learning to see represents the first preliminary schooling for spirituality. I'm not sure what that means. One must learn not to react immediately to a stimulus, but instead to take control of the inhibiting, excluding instincts. By the same token, every characteristic absence of spirituality, every piece of common vulgarity, is due to an inability to resist a stimulus. The inability to sit and know in opposition, reacting immediately, yielding to every impulse, already amounts to illness and represents a symptom of exhaustion. For Nietzsche, the vita contemplativa is not a matter of passive affirmation or being open to whatever happens. Instead, it offers resistance to crowding, intrusive stimuli. Hahn notes that as a mode of saying no, sovereign action proves more active than any and all hyperactivity, which represents a symptom of mental exhaustion. Hahn argues that what eludes Arendt in the dialectic of being active is that hyperactive intensification leads to an abrupt switch into hyperpassivity. Now one obeys every impulse or stimulus without resistance. But it's an illusion to believe that being more active means being freer. If we are open to everything, then we are likely open to nothing. If we don't rank or put value on some of the possibilities that we have, then we will not have a criteria for choice. Hahn contends that only by the negative means of making pause can the subject of action thoroughly measure the sphere of contingency. Although delaying does not represent a positive deed, it proves necessary if action is not to sink to the level of laboring. Hahn then argues that in the course of general acceleration and hyperactivity, we are also losing the capacity for rage. Mm-hmm. Rage has a characteristic temporality incompatible with generalized acceleration and hyperactivity, which admit no breath of time. In contrast, rage puts the present as a whole into question. It presupposes an interrupting pause in present. This is what distinguishes it from anger. The general distraction afflicting contemporary society does not allow the emphasis and energy of rage to rise. Rage is the capacity to interrupt a given state and make a new state begin. Today, it's yielding more and more to offense and annoyance. Having a beef which proves incapable of effecting decisive change. Hahn complains that mounting positivization of society weakens feelings such as rage and also dread and mourning, which are based on a kind of negativity. They are negative feelings. According to Hahn, the computer calculates more quickly than the human brain and takes on inordinate quantities of data without difficulty because it is free of all otherness. It is a machine of positivity. Because of autistic self-referentiality, because negativity is absent, an idiot savant can perform what otherwise only a calculator can do, Hahn writes. The general positivization of the world means that both human beings and society are transforming into autistic performance machines. There are two forms of potency. Positive potency is the power to do something. Negative potency, in contrast, is the power not to do. To adopt Nietzsche's phrasing, the power to say no. If only one possessed the positive ability to perceive something and not the negative ability not to perceive it, one's senses would stand utterly at the mercy of rushing, intrusive stimuli and impulses. In such a case, no spirituality would be possible. The negativity of not to provides an essential trait of contemplation. In Zen meditation, for example, one attempts to achieve the pure negativity of not to, that is, the void, by freeing oneself from rushing, intrusive something. Such meditation is an extremely active process, that is, it represents anything but passivity. All right, that more or less does it for this week. Next week, we're going to start with a chapter in which Hahn takes on Bartleby, a short story by Melville. So, let's see. Bartleby the short story is called Bartleby the Scrivener. It was published in 1853. It's subtitled A Story of Wall Street. It's a very nice story. It's a story in which a Wall Street attorney hires a new clerk who gradually stops doing any work and engaging others, and he begins to withdraw into himself. Anytime someone asks him to do a task, he responds, "I would prefer not to." The story is quite strange and interesting. And it's like an enigma. There are parts of it that you have to fill in yourself. So perhaps if you have a chance, you have a look at it. The story is made into films a number of times. You can find two or three different versions on YouTube. It's called Bartleby by Herman Melville. And if you get a chance, you can also have a look at this book, The Burnout Society by Byung-Hun. It is available for free at usarchive.org. All right. I think that should do it for this week. And we'll see each other next week. Thank you for being with us.
A friend of mine called me up not long ago. He knew me since I was knee-high to a grasshopper. But I evidently didn't give him the right answer, because he said to me, "Mink, schmink, money, shmoney, think you're hot now, don't you, honey? What have you got if you haven't got love? Silk, schmilk, satin, schmatten, a penthouse high in old Manhattan. That's not enough if you haven't got love. Happiness is not a thing that you can buy. It takes loving, lots of loving, from the right guy. Pearls, schmearls, and Herman Schmerman, from Jim or Jack or Joe or Herman. That's not enough if you haven't got love. Ring, schming, jewelry, schmoolery. Don't you know that's just tomfoolery? What have you got if you haven't got love? Cars, schmars, and princes, schminces, with caviar and chicken blintzes, don't mean a thing if you haven't got love. Love is just a simple thing that you can't buy. You can't get it wholesale, darling. Why try? Tips, schmips, angle, schmangle, play around and get entangled. What have you got if you haven't got? Haven't got a take the Jaguar on the right.
You are listening to KTVS Davis, 90.3 FM. The following views presented in this hour do not reflect the views of KTVS, KTVS sponsors, or the University of California. Up next, The Smile Show, after these messages.
My son Aiden has asthma. Secondhand smoke has triggered his asthma so badly, he ended up in the emergency room and spent multiple nights in intensive care. Now he's on a whole bunch of medications. My tip to you is, don't be shy about telling people not to smoke around your kids.
Half of U.S. kids are exposed to secondhand smoke. If you or someone you know wants help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and CDC.
Doctors Without Borders delivers medical emergency aid to victims of war, armed conflict, natural and man-made disasters, and to others who lack health due to the social or geographical isolation. Doctors Without Borders is a private nonprofit organization which needs your help to bring primary health care to remote, isolated areas where resources and training are limited. For more information about Doctors Without Borders or to volunteer overseas, visit the website at www.doctorswithoutborders.org.
Common sense, baby. All it takes to keep your family healthy this flu season. The California Association for Nurse Practitioners says simple steps like frequently washing hands, getting plenty of rest, and reducing stress can help ward off the flu. Simple steps for a healthy America.
Well-being, empowerment. Welcome to this week's edition of The Smiles Show and Podcast Smiles. Join our host, Jimmy Smiles, as we connect virtually. And now, here's Jimmy.
And here I am, already back for another round, another edition, another chance to connect with you all here on The Smiles Show. I'm your host, Jimmy Smiles, and this is a weekly public affairs program. And first of all, welcome to all the listeners out there, whether you are new to the show, a returning listener, or somewhere in between. I'm always glad to have you along for the ride, because without listeners, I don't have a show. And then I'm just talking to myself and or talking to my cat. And my cat, he gets so tired of hearing from me all the time. Exactly. In fact, he's in the other room right now. I don't know how many of you ever have like rodent issues in your home. I live here in Davis, and right now it's the time of year, of course, where the weather is getting cooler, so a lot of the field mice and so forth are looking for warmth. And of course, that means they're looking for places inside where the humans often hang out, obviously. And so Roger has been spending a lot of time, my cat Roger, has been spending a lot of time staring under the oven. And so he's not waiting for me to cook anything, because I cook maybe like 3 times a year. So there's not too much cooking going on in my kitchen, but apparently there must be a mouse or something in the kitchen, because he's been extremely focused in the kitchen the last 3 or 4 days. So I will keep you posted on the saga of Roger and the mouse as things continue to develop. In any case, welcome aboard to this week's edition of the show. This is a public affairs program. Welcome back to all the KDVS listeners. So, of course, the previous show was preempted due to UC Davis women's basketball. Go Aggs. And a big round of applause for all of the women's basketball players at UC Davis, as well as all of the sports programs at UC Davis. So occasionally the Smile Show and or other shows on KDVS 90.3 FM get preempted due to sports games. And so it's part of the commitment of KDVS.